You're listening to a nerdy production.
Warning, this is a nerdy production. Welcome into the GM Workshop. My name is Jacob, and my mission in this podcast is to dig up tacit knowledge about role-playing games so we can be better GMs and create great stories, great moments around the table as a GM. And I will try to bring you episodes each Wednesday, plus reviews, action play podcasts, and maybe some bonus episodes coming up your way. Reach out to us on the GM Workshop at Facebook, Twitter, and Discord, and subscribe to the podcast in any podcast app you are using. And now, on to today's episode.
Roll for initiative.
Welcome inside the Game Master Workshop. Today we are talking Call of Cthulhu, and with me from the UK are Lynn. She's a game designer for Chaosium and a lot of other stuff, and eager to jump in to talk about Call of Cthulhu, of course, and D100 system, and beat my frustration out of me. So let's take that on a later notice. But first, as always, Lynn, can you talk to listeners where you come from, role-playing wise, and what you are doing in this time and moment in your nerdy career?
Well, I got into role-playing games at university my first year there, through all things American football, which is a slightly strange way of getting into it. I mean, I knew role-playing games existed. I was aware of them, usually through bad press rather than good press. Obviously, I remember seeing D&D in E.T. when I went to see that at the Pictures, although to be fair, I had flu when I went to see E.T., so I wasn't entirely certain I hadn't dreamed that entire bit where they're playing D&D, but it turns out I hadn't. So I go to university, it's Freshers Week, I'm in a hall of residence at Newcastle University that's 3 miles out of the centre. It had its own little bar because public transport to and from the city centre was not great at that point in time. So if you went into town, it was quite hard to get back again. So they tended to do a lot of their own entertainment on site. And I wore my Seattle Seahawks football top to go to the first night party, because me and my dad used to watch football, American football, on British television on Sunday afternoons together, because it was quite a big thing in the sort of mid to late 80s over here in the UK. And Seattle Seahawks was actually quite a tough one to get hold of. It wasn't one of the fashionable ones that you could pick up in supermarkets or pretty much anywhere.
It was the Raiders and the Redskins.
The Cowboys, you know, things like that. So Seahawks was a bit unusual. And a couple of young gentlemen approached me, and it turned out that they were actually on the university's American football team. And they'd spotted me because I was wearing this unusual top. And we got talking, and it turned out that they were gamers, and they invited me to join their group. And I was really excited because it was something I'd always fancied trying. And the rest, as they say, is history.
The history, yeah. And then that's the history you want to jump in today. So it was Dungeons and Dragons back then,
No, RuneQuest was actually the very first game I played, and I played a dwarf called Shirley. That I inherited from somebody else. My first GM was a guy called John Wilson, and I squarely lay the blame for everything that follows at his feet. And he knows this because we're still occasionally in touch. The way the group was set up was that pretty much everybody in the group GM'd. There was only one person who didn't, and that's because he didn't enjoy it. So pretty much everybody in the group had their system, and John's system was RuneQuest. So I came along. He thought it would be easier to let me have an old character sheet that a friend of his at school had played. So I inherited Shirley, and she was great.
Yeah, I can understand, because it was a tough beat to make characters in RuneQuest.
Partly that, but also
it was a process.
It's partly that, but it was also the fact that he used to run RuneQuest at his school club, and somebody'd stolen all of his books, so he was literally running it from memory. So he didn't really have the materials there for me to be able to create a new character. But Shirley was awesome. I loved Shirley to bits. She was absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. We used to tell some amazing stories. And not long after I started playing, they'd all been role-playing since they were at school, and they wanted to play D&D. So they basically told me that I was going to run Redbox D&D for them. So yes, the first thing I GM'd was D&D, but that wasn't the first game that I played.
Oh, okay. But that's also... it's just a GM workshop. This so why was it the Dungeons and Dragons part of the game that you picked up back then? Was that because of the group pressure?
Yes, they wanted to play it again. They'd thoroughly enjoyed playing Redbox D&D when they were at school, and they hadn't played it in ages. And because they all had their systems that they were running, and they had ongoing campaigns that I was joining, they didn't really want to drop those and pick up D&D. So I was new. It seemed like a nice, straightforward thing for me to pick up and start. And I enjoyed it, but I always felt that they knew more about it than I did, so I wanted a system of my own that they didn't know, which was how I picked up Talislanta.
Let's talk about that, because that's a weird one. That's a very niche game. So why that game?
The first reason that I even knew about it was that I kept seeing the adverts for it in gaming magazines, which was No Elves, and I thought, oh hello, that looks interesting. It also had PD Breeding Black's art on it, and she's an amazing artist, and that also attracted me. So I managed to get hold of, I think the first version I have is second edition. And I picked that up, and it was nice and straightforward. It's a D20 system. You had lots of little archetypes that you could pick to be characters. It's a very rich world, and I fell in love with it, and I really felt that that was something I could make my own, that I could surprise the rest of the group with, that they wouldn't know what was coming.
So they didn't know the rules, they didn't know the worlds, and then you couldn't create some stories that wasn't straightforward for them to figure out at beforehand.
Exactly, yes. Yes, it was all new, it was all discovery for them, you know, that so I could surprise them and tell the sorts of stories that I wanted to tell that I didn't think that Redbox necessarily would allow me to tell, particulars they knew all the background, they knew all of that stuff.
So that game was the actually first really good DM experience for you in some sense, or was it the...
Oh, don't get me wrong, I enjoyed DMing D&D. I learnt a lot from doing it in the sort of like the few months that I did it, but yes, Talislanta was definitely my first true DMing love.
Sure. Moving into, if you want to create a group this Friday with some new players, how do you want to figure this out for a gaming group? What do you bring to the table, and what do you demand for your players to bring to the table? For instance, a Call of Cthulhu game. What do you expect, and what does the players expect for you?
Well, hopefully the players expect a fun and entertaining time. What I like from my players is a sense of curiosity and a willingness to engage. I mean, this is a horror game. We all know that in a common sense situation, if your brain was working properly, most of the situations in horror games and scenarios, you know, you just look at, no, I'm not going down into that basement because obviously there's something hideous down there. Or no, I'm not going to split the party. I'm not going to wander off and leave all my friends because we're going to get picked off one by one. Now, in the real world, you would think, you would hope that, you know, you would have more sense than that. But the whole thing is that horror scenarios, horror games, they work a lot on established tropes. So, you know, I'm looking for a group that are willing to engage with that, to put common sense to one side and throw themselves into the whole ludicrous setup and run with it.
Fiasco, the game Fiasco has this great term. Play your character as you are just owning a car and want to get away from the police. always jump into to action. Always jump into to where the conflict are, so you can make the greatest stories for yourself, the GM, and the players around you. So that's great. It's a great way to create stories with your players, for sure.
Expect
some. Demand something for your players, from your players. A lot of game masters, I tend to acknowledge that, do not have this courage to demand something for their players, from their players. But you are a player at the table as well as a DM. So if you don't have fun, you are not having fun. So let the players help you have this fun. And if they don't want to go down to the dark basement, then you can meet up next Friday and they can try again, because that it was down in the basement where the story lie. So
I mean, there are ways around that, you know. You can, if they won't go into the basement, you can move it into whichever room that they do want to go in and then completely surprise them.
Yes.
But I mean, you made a very valid point there. The whole point is that everybody is there to have fun, and it's supposed to be fun for the GM and the players. You know, you're supposed to work together to entertain each other, create your story, and have fun.
Yeah, and don't go solo gaming for as, and the worst case is if the game master are solo gaming, as you said. The if the plot are only in the basement, you cannot move it around. You have said that it was fixed point there, and if the players don't find the door because they missed their investigation check or whatever, then
we're starting early, are we? Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say something wrong?
Yes, missing your investigation check. We'll have a chat more about that later when we come on to that topic. But yes, it's a common misconception about Call of Cthulhu and about missing and failing things. But yes, let's have a bit more of a talk about that later.
I was teasing you. So it's but yeah. Make sure that you move the plot around, or make the players know where you to find the story and help, and but still make the game about the players and have them be the protagonist in the story.
Exactly. No. You are there to guide and facilitate your players, and they are there to engage with your outline. And, you know, be flexible. Listen to what your players are after, be prepared to move things around, and you know, sometimes they may just want to head off in completely the opposite direction, and sometimes it's not going to hurt for you to let them do that. In some weeks, everybody just needs to say, like, okay, fair enough, we know the cultists are over there doing X, but really, can we actually just go to the scary library and spend a bit of time doing this, or going to the speakeasy and just, you know, letting our hair down a little bit. And just, you know, let them get that out of their system, and then you can take them back to the plot. Or you can use them letting their hair down to get them into real trouble that will steer them gently back to the plot.
So, and often in Call of Cthulhu, as especially, it's an investigational game. So if you want a tight investigation game, as I talked to Dempsey, and I'll talk with him, it's pretty tight structures in where the game are, because you have to make a investigation game that are in coherent with the realism in where the plot are, so you cannot improvise so many things in the story, but you can you have to have a lot of open space for the players to navigate in without make them lose their agency as a player. So finding
exactly
that balance in an investigation game is so very tough and very hard to move around.
It is tricky, but as long as you know what the key important points are that they have to find, and as long as you, and this is where pre-game preparedness comes in, pre-game preparation, is what are your key bits of information that they need to find for this information, this investigation to move ahead. Where else might they find those bits of information? Who else might give them that information if they don't go to the place that you originally put it? And as long as you kind of like, you have rough plans for that before you get going, you should be fine. At the end of the day, if you really do have to just come up with something, don't worry about it. Keep going. Or just say, oh, I wasn't expecting you to do that. Let's just have a comfort break and give me 5-10 minutes to think about how that's going to fit in. And, you know, never be afraid to say, wow, you've just come up with a great idea. I'm going to try and incorporate that. Because, again, that helps players feel invested because you're listening to them.
And give them agency in the story. We want to create a story together. That's the key,
exactly,
key mark for me in many, many sakes. And in that... in that essence, that's the session zero and the first talk with your players are so very important for me to emphasize this. This is a co-op storytelling assignment. So I will give a lot of things. I've give outlines, and maybe you maybe create some handouts, some sound handouts, some paper clippings, whatever. But that's are not key for me to show you. They are cool, but if I can formulate a great session zero with my players, they want that story, and they want the handouts in the story flow and the sound handouts and the whatever, and so that it feels natural for them, so they feel they are invested in the story, so they have invested agency. And if they find some weird way to come to through the plot holes I have created, that's fine, and we will go there. But most cases we have a deal or meet a deal to find a way through this investigational scenario, because the players trust me. If we have this session zero, the players should trust me enough to let them be let into a stories they can interact with for so many reasons.
Yeah. And session zeros are good for something else as well, because horror comes in lots of different flavors. So a session zero is very good to establish what flavor your Call of Cthulhu game is going to be. Is it going to be cosmic horror, grim, nihilistic? Or is it going to be more pulpy in style? And sometimes problems occur at a table because people they've got different conceptions, preconceptions of what the game is going to be. So someone might think that they're doing a pulp type game, and someone might think they're doing grim nihilistic horror. Some might think they're doing slasher horror. So obviously they all want very different things from a story. And if you have that session zero and you find out what people want, then you can make sure that you're tailoring your game to meet that, so that people aren't surprised, disappointed, not quite sure where things are going once you actually get the game going.
Yeah, because if you can formulate what kind of horror Lynn wants to bring to the table and what kind of horror I as a player Jacob wants to experience, if we can find some coherence in that area, that's the perfect solution for sure. But if I want a really pulpy, like Actum Cthulhu kind of game, and you want a slow burn Lovecraft Charles Dexter Ward kind of book, that's not gonna work. So we have to find some common grounds, or let's say, okay, fine, we take Actum Cthulhu in this chapter of the game, and next chapter we are going more Charles Dexter Ward on the game. So we have to find these balances for sure, and that's pretty hard sometimes.
Exactly. I mean, it can be, but you know, having been the line editor for Actum Cthulhu, you can do both in that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But still, it could ruin the very slow burn horror if you go in too much Actum Cthulhu and vice versa. So it's because building up a horror mood is pretty hard at a table. For many players out there, they're still playing online, so that's a horrific job to bring horror to a TV screen. For my experience, for instance, so not having this session zero before, it's still pretty hard, I imagined. Let's move into Call of Cthulhu. I think we have a pretty good idea where you are as a GM, for sure, and what do you want to emphasize to a table? Today's topic is Call of Cthulhu by Kyosium. Lynn is a game designer from Kyosium, and we will talk about the game and how to play it, and of course the D100 system.
Check out our Facebook page, GM Workshop the Podcast, Discord and Twitter if you want to interact with us or be on the podcast. Reach out to us so you can give us your GM advice and perspectives on your favorite game.
Famous last words. So let's move into Call of Cthulhu and what you are relation to Call of Cthulhu. Let's start there, because you are a co-writer for Call of Cthulhu. And have a lot of say or have a lot of authorious abilities in that area. So let's start there. Why did you and how did you land in this dream job for us, for our nerd Lovecraft nerds.
Purely by being in the right place at the right time and knowing the right people. Call of Cthulhu, funnily enough, was the game that John used to run or picked up and ran as Light Relief. And that usually makes people laugh. And when I say Light Relief, it was as a break from running the RuneQuest campaign. So it was something that we would play every now and again, one-offs. So I was always aware of it. I mean, I have to admit that, you know, I'm not a fan of horror films. I don't particularly read horror novels, or I certainly didn't used to. So, you know, it always amuses people the fact that I actually work on Call of Cthulhu, because I don't watch a lot of horror films and stuff like that. But I don't mind writing it, because I can control it.
Yeah, you are the boss.
I'm in control of the horror at that point. I am active in it. I'm not passively consuming it. And that's the difference between horror role-playing games and horror books and horror films, is that it's very active participation. It's not passive consumption. And that makes a huge difference. But really, it was a case of I was running stuff for various different games. I was doing lots of live role-playing. And we got involved in a campaign called Company of Crimson, which was run by a live role-playing campaign, which was run by friends of ours that me and my husband knew from university. And it was effectively Cthulhu by gaslight. And so it had this, you know, amazing Victorian aesthetic. We would dress up, we would go out for tea, we would go to museums, but there was this strong element of mythos horror running underneath it. So that kind of got me into things. And then that morphed into a 1920s game, which was called Crimson League. And then that morphed into a 1940s game, which was codenamed Crimson. And around this time, when it got to codenamed Crimson, I was looking to get out of being a biomedical sciences lecturer and trying to work out what other career I could actually do. And I'd been writing on and off for role-playing games for quite a long time by that point. And my husband Richard was talking to Sarah Newton at Dragon Meet, and she was talking about this game that she and Chris Birch were developing called Actum Cthulhu. And, you know, she encouraged Rich to encourage me to get back in touch with her and Chris as and when I was available. And that was how I got into it. I was in the right place at the right time. I wrote to Chris just as he was planning to launch the Actum Cthulhu Kickstarter. I was originally going to be a researcher to another writer, and they dropped out. So I kind of fell into the role of line editor and developer on that one for the Kickstarter books. And that was a real baptism of fire, because although I'd written and edited, I'd never been that involved in a project. I'd not been sort of like drawing up book outlines and goodness knows what. So yes, that was quite a baptism of fire, that project. But that's how I got to meet Mike Mason, and start working with him. And after I left Modiphius, that I started to do more work for Chaosium, and then he basically trained me up, and I started to work in more of an editorial capacity on various books. And then I think it's almost 3 or 4 years ago now, I was taken on full time as the associate editor for Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah. So it's just to have our listeners to know who you are and why I'm talking Call of Cthulhu with you. So you have your credentials in order. When moving into the 20s horror, when you're setting a mood in this, what are the key elements for you to set up a game like this, and what tools can you give our GMs out there in?
Well, the 1920s is a very visual time. It's a very wild time. It's a very exciting time. Unfortunately, it seems like our 20s is trying its best to like imitate them, which not necessarily great, but because it is kind of just still within living memory, You know, there's a lot of resources out there that you can go to that can help you get the feel. There's lots of images that you can get. There's obviously records, popular music from the time that you can get, that you can all use to help set the tone if you like that kind of thing. And again, this is something to establish in a session zero, because some people like using music as background to the scenarios, but other people don't. So, you know, you can help use music to set your tone. You've got all these visual references. It's a time that we know quite a lot about. It's a fascinating time because it's a real change in the way that society is structured because of the fallout from the Great War. Everything else that's developing as a result of the Great War, you know, things are starting to become modern. You know, there are elements that we, even though we're 100 years later, can still recognize that are still familiar, which helps to really get your players immersed in it, because it is, there is that familiarity there. But also, there's that the past is another country, they do things differently there element as well. So you can, again, you can twist things. People will happily go with that. Because it isn't now, it isn't, you know, we don't know exactly what it was like from our own personal perspective because we weren't there. And it's one of the interesting things that I've learned over the years with running things in historical games is that it's far easier to sell the lie if it's rooted in the truth and rooted in something that seems familiar. And that's one of the things that makes the 1920s a great place to set games. And it's one of the things that makes Call of Cthulhu such an effective game, is because it could almost be real.
Yes. And that's the primary... my games are... Yeah, it's primary only in our own world by now. And I'm not playing a lot of fantasy anymore, because I love the horror thing in the games. I play a lot of Alien as well, so it's not mm-hmm. quite what I said, but it's still our own world, but in the future. but yeah.
But it's not too far removed. No. You know, you look at Alien and Aliens, yeah. That's sort of recognisable technology, even if it's in the far future. So there's enough there that you can recognise that, you know, it feels comfortable. But then you've got those elements that make it terrifying as well.
It's a lot more, it's not easier to immerse yourself into a human than an elf, barbarian, dragonkin, whatever. And when you can immerse into a guy or man from the 1920s, it's more real when you experience horror with somebody shoots a shotgun after in you, or you look down in the dark basement and don't dare to go there until the other guys are come back from the car and whatever. So it gives a lot of flavor in the moments to when we play in our own world. When we are playing humans, we are not playing supernaturals, we are not playing whatever. It's more easier for us as DMs to emphasize the horror for players when we are rooted, when it's rooted in the own,
because it's recognizable and we know how frail human beings are, so it's more frightening because you know therefore how frail your character is too,
and all the small things. We know how the floor feels when you move with bare 3 feet in the morning because it's cold and so on. So all the mm-hmm. feelings and all the sounds, the taste and so on, you can put a lot of things into a description and a narrative for players when it's rooted.
Yeah.
So and the 1920s are a weird time for many sakes in Scandinavia and Europe. It was a pretty weird time. It's just in the aftermath of the first real war, the first great war. But in the US, where most of Call of Cthulhu's classical are set in the eastern of US, there's a lot of a turmoil, or more not turmoil. It's pretty conservative, and there's a lot of still water in that area. So how do you use this very boring setting because it is pretty boring actually. It's from the outside. It's there's not a lot of action. There are not a lot of big conspiracies and so on.
I think the Chicago mob would probably argue with you on that point. I mean, this is the whole point. It's set during Prohibition. You do have an awful lot of conflict and a lot of movement, and you've got Hollywood is starting up. So you've got a lot of social development. It is different to Europe.
Yep.
But you do have social development. You do have things going on. But again, you've got all these horrible little creepy, quiet, hidden away places that goodness knows what's going on in them. You don't really know. And this is the interesting thing. I mean, if you read Conan Doyle and you read Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes and Poirot both loathe the countryside because you've got no idea what's going on behind those lace curtains in these tiny little hidden out of the way villages, because they're so isolated. The rest of society never really reaches them. So you've got, so maybe there's not all the bright lights and goodness knows what of Chicago and Al Capone and everybody blowing each other to pieces, but you've got that creeping, quiet, nasty horror that's going to jump out from under the stairs at you. And that's great, you know, if you want that sort of quiet, creeping, psychological horror thing going on, then that bit of New England's absolutely perfect for it. But you can also have it with all the gangster stuff, because I mean, Arkham, there's various bits in Arkham that, you know, there's they've got their speakeasies, they've got their mob connections. Yes. So if you want that kind of like pulpy action type thing, you can do that too.
Yeah. So yeah, because if you set this classic setting in Chicago or the out in the West where the gold rush are in the ending days and so on, and the Native Americans are still roaring some societies and so on, you can put in a lot of that stuff. But in the classic Lovecraftian, it's the New England, as you said, the very gray area in the U.S. For most cases, it's not the big cities, it's not the metropolitans for Washington or New York or so on. It's a pretty gray area. So setting that mood for players and giving them this as an outline. How do we make great horror in this setting, Lynn?
Well, like I said, don't forget that Boston is not far away. Boston is a very important and vibrant city, and you can do all your pulpy stuff there too. Mm-hmm. But like I said, if you're going for your original Lovecrafty type setting with Arkham and Dunwich and places like that, you're really going for that creeping, slow, inexorable cosmic horror type thing. You're doing your Cabin in the Woods, Hideous Thing Down the Mine, you know, that slow horror. But you can bring pulp elements into it as well. You can have your cults that you need to go up against. You can have your big fight against the monster at the end. And again, it depends on what flavour of horror you're going for. But Arkham and the Miskatonic region, there's plenty of meat there for you to get your teeth into, really, whatever you want. I mean, I tend to go for the quiet. I like quiet character-driven pieces. So it's the interactions of the characters as they're working through these mysteries, these investigations. But then every now and again, I like to do pulp. And you can do both. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if you want quiet, creeping horror, you would set something out in the woods out beyond Dunwich. If you want something a bit more town mystery place, you know, you could set something in around Miskatonic University, because let's face it, Arkham's a thriving town at the time of the books. So, you know, there's plenty of industry and stuff going on. There's plenty of things. It, as in all these things, as we've already mentioned, it depends on what you and your group are looking for. But I wouldn't say that Miskatonic was grey. There's a lot going on in there.
It's a weird city, and it's a pretty weird city for sure, and at a great university.
I mean, if you think that you've got Kingsport on the coast, I mean, that's a thriving port.
Yeah.
You've got Innsmouth, which is weird.
Yeah.
Innsmouth is special.
Yeah. read the book.
Pretty special.
Read the novel. so you can have some ideas.
But you know, you do have all these different types of places, so you're not limited. And like you said, it's that all may be imaginary, but you do have real cities close by that you can still get to do other things in as well. You know, so you've got that very isolated, you know, the opportunity for isolated stories, but you've still got that opportunity for the outside world to sort of like crowd its way in and force its way in, which quite a lot in horror stories is when the action happens, is when outsiders who don't understand how things work try and force their attitudes and views on locked communities.
Yeah, like screw it up for them for some. And this limits, it's there's a lot of limits in this genre or this this area to play in, as you said, but it's also makes it a great setting, so the limits can turn on the screws on the players, and that they have to figure out the story right there in Innsmouth or in Kingsport or something like that.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure at a session zero from the beginning that it's in Kingsport the story is. It's not in Innsmouth, it's not in Boston, it's not anything else. It's in Kingstown, in Kingsport. So you have to make sure the players are into this and the roles are, or the characters are in, it makes sense that the characters are in Kingsport to figure out this plot.
Yeah.
So limit the players and make it more tightening the screws and use the setting, because it's a great setting to use, because there's so much stuff written for this setting for sure.
And if you know what you want, you can really exploit it.
Yeah.
And it's as you say, it's knowing what you want, it's having everyone understanding what the setting is, what the framework is, and how they all fit together into that.
Yes.
And as you said, session zero is the place you do that.
To figure out what kind of story do we want to tell. Is it the Cthulhu Cthulhu, or it's more low-key? Is it, are we all into that it's this town, it's this town we are playing the story, it's not in Boston or New York or Chicago or whatever. But when we're talking Call of Cthulhu, we cannot come the legacy of Lovecraft. Lovecraft was a great writer, but not such a great person. For so many reasons, but he is of course child of his time, and
no, he was pretty bad even for his time. It was widely acknowledged. I mean, even Robert E. Howard was sort of like going, "Mate, you're a bit extreme." You know, he was
bad.
Not a nice person.
No, he was.
But we can't pretend that he wasn't that he was. You know, you have to acknowledge it. But the important thing with the Cthulhu mythos, certainly for me, is that pretty much from the outset, it was a shared world. It wasn't just him. There were a lot of other writers involved. You had August Derleth, Robert E. Howard, Clark Ashton Smith, numerous people. And as a shared world, it's actually one of those ones that really it leads nicely into role-playing, because different generations have made the mythos what they've needed it to be. Well, it's our mythos now. It's up to us to tell the stories that we want to tell in it. Doesn't matter what stories Lovecraft was telling. Yes, he was there at the beginning, but, you know, it's ours now. We do what we want. We tell the stories we want to tell, while acknowledging the fact that he was a pretty horrific, repulsive
but
person.
But when we're working on this, we have to acknowledge that Lovecraft wasn't a racist idiot, but he have created something special for us to take over and to create some great stories in that sense of the and that is the legacy we want to bring on to our table, to our gaming
it's
table.
It's that shared world creation legacy. That's the really core. An interesting thing about Call of Cthulhu is its long history of shared world creation.
Yeah. And it's open source, so everybody can use it. So it's pretty cool. There's some some
It's really not, actually. That's the weird thing. People think it is. It's totally not. Anything that Lovecraft wrote on his own is public domain. But he actually wrote a lot with other people, which means that things that people think are open source really aren't.
Yeah, but the basics are open for many reasons. So yeah, there's a lot of things like the stuff Ken Hyde have created with the yellow signs and so on are not public domain and so on. So of course, and
well, that's yellow sign and Carcosa's Robert Chambers, which is actually earlier than Lovecraft. Lovecraft was a fan of Robert Chambers' stuff.
So there's a lot of stuff in that. So that not all everything are open source, but a lot of it's are open source. So we can create a lot of stuff for ourselves. So one of the problems for me when I'm DMing and playing Call of Cthulhu are the cosmic horror thing. It's for me it's too big, it's too noisy, and it's the small horror in the dangerous basement, as we talked about in the beginning. It's the weird man who stares at the grocery at you constantly and so on. It's there where the horror is. It's not the cosmic demon thingies in the universe and all the cosmic gods and so on. It's not where I find the setting interesting. How can we use the cosmic horror in a better way, then? So we might can give our players some better experience in this term?
You give them glimpses of it. You build up slowly to it by giving them these glimpses. I mean, if you're doing a one shot, like a one-off scenario, it's perfectly fine to throw Cthulhu in right at the end as the big wow, because it doesn't matter if they all go completely insane and die. Because it's a one-off, you know, you've crafted it specifically for that wow factor. Yikes, you know, old Squiddy Chops himself has turned up and it's game over kind of thing. But if you want to run a campaign, you need to build it slowly with just little glimpses, little hints. And then eventually there's more hints and the pieces start to fall into place. And then at the end, I mean, you still might not get to see the entire creature, but you might come to understand more of it and understand just how tiny a speck you are in the grand scheme of things. But you don't have to have a monster jump out and sort of like scream at your players, your investigators, because quite often the most effective horror is not what you see, it's what you think, it's what you imply. I mean, we all know, I mean, you know, having grown up in Britain, in the 1970s and 80s and Doctor Who, it was always way more scary when you didn't see the monster. You heard the monster, you saw its shadow, you saw the aftermath of where it had been. Usually when they showed you the monster, it was immensely disappointing because it was a guy in a rubber suit. Or in one notable case, it was a guy wrapped up in bubble wrap, painted green.
Yeah. And making that distinction between to let us our players be protagonist, as in Dungeons and Dragons terms, that we have to figure out how to get to the end boss in the lake and kill old Squiddy guy. Formulate that to a group of players, especially if they come from the D&D setting or D&D environment. It's pretty hard to let them be disappointed in some way. So it's called Call of Cthulhu, and so let's call Call of Cthulhu and kill it. So find. find these details and how to create great stories and let the details figure out, because when they figure out the details, it's they are doomed, and giving the players that knowledge that the players are not winning this game, the cosmic horror are too
big. that's it. Yes, it's the downward spiral. Yes. But if your players are coming from the D&D background and they kind of expect that, why not start them off with Pulp? Give them a bit more of a hope. But again, we're going back to session zero again. It's explaining to them that, you know, this isn't D&D. You're not going to win. The whole thing here is the downward spiral, because you are this tiny insignificant speck. And at the end of the day, all you can do is try and save humanity for a little bit longer.
It's
you know, but yeah, pulp. I mean, pulp is a great way to bring in players who are used to more of the hack and slash. You could maybe even do a couple of one-offs where it's the whole gung-ho total party kill, mm-hmm. but go down in a blaze of glory thing, which, you know, quite often has happened at my table for convention games, which these days is most of what I run. Yeah. But you can get away with it in one-shot things. Yeah. And it helps to establish the different flavour and tone. And, you know, again, it's this whole conversation with your players so that they understand what they're coming into, mm-hmm. if it's not something they've done before.
Yeah. So but also some formulate to the players that this game is rigged. You're not going to win. so it's that's not.
You will have minor victories. Yeah. You will have minor victories, but you will never succeed in the end.
Because there's a lot of other games out there so that have some of the same terms in games, like the Alien game as I talked on before. It's also a rigged game. You cannot defeat all the aliens, but in that game there's a mechanic or a contract with the players and the GM that you lose your characters, but you give another character that are linked into the game, so you can kill off your characters easily and make great stories in the kill of a character.
Exactly. So. But, you know, you tend to find that players don't mind their investigators dying as long as they die gloriously. Yeah. You know, give them that opportunity to have that glorious character death.
Yes.
And then they'll be quite happy to talk about that for years to come.
Yeah.
You know, if they, because it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But make it interesting, make it entertaining, and then people just don't mind.
Yep.
You know, that they're quite happy with that.
For sure. Any other horror games? I've talked to Robin, as you know, and I know you have heard that episode, and he is the cult oracle and the cult Divinity Lost GM mm-hmm. in that game, and that's the premise in that game. Are vice versa that Call of Cthulhu, that we still start off as a normal people, but in our journey through the plot, it's very hard, and through the meta plot, we become divine creatures of God. We are more than the angels and the demons that try to kill us through the meta plot. So in that term, mm-hmm. it's not a downward spiral, it's a downward spiral that becomes an upward spiral if we survive it. So it's another way to use this cosmic horror, because it's basically the same.
But you're, the whole thing there is you're losing your humanity,
aren't
you? You're no longer human by the end of it.
It's not.
And that's it. When you look at the Cthulhu stories, it's usually about a lone person learning more than they should really know and losing their humanity.
Yes. So, then. So we're going into this hot potato topic, I will start off my frustration of the D100 system, and then we can break it off to you afterwards. No, I've played a lot of D100 systems. I've played the Warm Roleplay, RuneQuest, as you have, Call of Cthulhu, of course, and the basic roleplay versions in different capacities, and I always fail system where my players roll one percentage above what they should, and then I cannot give them a clue. They're not hitting the orc in the head, so they, and so on. It's so difficult for me as a GM to figure out the D100 systems and how to navigate it. I love the mechanic. It's a bit an improv thing in the new version of Call of Cthulhu, the lock mechanic. I love that for sure, but it's mm-hmm. just a patchwork meta currency thing you have put onto the system, and it's pretty good, and I love it. So it's not it's fine. But the frustration in the D100 system that I'm never going to play D100 systems in a horror game again.
Well, that's a real shame.
Yeah, because
okay. Let me see if I can convince
yeah, for sure.
you. Okay. Now, a lot of this comes down to a misunderstanding.
Yes.
Now, in some of the original versions, like third edition before, I can't say because I have never actually read them. But it is a misconception. It's one of these ones, if somebody fails a roll, then they don't get the thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, tell me any other role-playing game where if you fail a roll, you don't, you know, something doesn't happen. It's in all role-playing systems. But there's this weird misconception about Call of Cthulhu in particular.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah, well, it's the
Mike and Paul went to very, very great lengths in 7th edition to point out the fact that, you know, that's library use is usually the one that's quoted.
Yeah,
so let's use library use. So you fail your library use roll. Mm-hmm. We're going to ignore luck for a moment. The rules actually say it's not that you don't find what you're looking for. It just takes you a very long time to find what you're looking for. Or you have to go get somebody to help you. Now, that may then give your antagonists an advantage because it's taken you so long to find something out that you're late turning up to stop them. So, you know, it's not that you don't get the information. It's just a complication that you failed. Okay, you fumble, something really untoward happens, and that's usually sometimes the most entertaining parts of the story. But there's this, you know, it's if your clue is that important, and again, this is in the rules, if your clue is that important that the failure to get that, failing a roll means the investigators don't get that clue, why are they rolling for it? They shouldn't be rolling for it. They should be able to discover that clue.
Yeah. And then
just by talking to people, by digging through things, you know, looking hard. If it's that essential to the plot, there shouldn't be a roll attached to it. Or if there is a role attached to it, there should be an alternative way for them to get hold of it that doesn't require a role. So again, you know, don't wall off essential information behind dice rolls, because it is frustrating if you do that. And like I said, it is a misconception, but it's one of these weird myths that is attached to the game that people just go, oh, well, it doesn't work. You know, if I fail my library use roll, that's it, the plot's over. And it's like, no, it's not. Look is very useful for that, because it's one of the shorthand ways of helping people get round this misconception. And I adore Look. I think it's one of the best things they did with 7th edition. I think it's fantastic because it allows players greater control, but they're also dicing with fate because they may need that Look later on. You know, when they really do need to, you know, if you're in combat and you really do need to make that dodge roll to get out of the way of the deep one having a go at you, but you've already spent all of your luck on things that, you know, you didn't necessarily need to. I always like to be fair with my players when we're using luck. You know, I will let them know if it's worth them spending luck to change the result. You know, if it's worth changing it from a regular success to a hard success or things like that. But the luck is a fantastic mechanic, which helps, as you say, to sort of like patch this misconception. But, you know, just to say it again, a failed roll should never stall the plot. If it's going to stall the plot, why are you rolling?
Yeah. And there was... It's a great point then, because if you want the plots to evolve or you want the players in some direction, make sure the clues are in front of the players in some capacity and not behind it, a dice roll. But then we are back to the maybe the misconception, but why are we using a system to use have a skill like your library use or investigate? I like the Trail of Cthulhu version of it, where we are just giving the player some clues, and then we are using points to figure out more clues or more helpful things. So put it in that term.
But that's exactly the same as levels of success.
Yes.
So you roll a regular success on your library use roll, you get that particular information. You roll a hard success, now you could maybe perhaps find it in half the time, or you might find out some other information that's useful. It's not the core information you need to move the plot forward, but it gives you a little bit more background. You know, it gives you interesting ideas, or, you know, perhaps might point you in a slightly different direction than the one you intended. Might be a shortcut. And again, it's this whole thing that, oh, you know, if you're having to, there's no point in having these skills. You know, if you don't have certain skills, okay, it's a long time since I've looked at Trail of Cthulhu, to be fair, but, you know, there's still things that you have to roll for. There's still things you can fail your roles up, which means you can't do things. Sometimes failure is an interesting driver of the plot. You know, it would be really boring if you just succeeded at everything. And it's always better to look at a fail as a yes but or a no but sort of situation, you know, so that it's there to create complications, it's there to add interest, it's there to send the plot off in a slightly different direction. It's not there to stop it dead.
Yeah, but then we are back to the library use rule, because if we have a character that have a lot of library use, he wants to use his skill because it's that arena he is good in, but you are not allowing him to roll for library use.
I would allow him to roll, but it's how fast he then finds that information.
Yeah, but if they are not, I can formulate this in a way, right way, if he are not allowed, if you find the clue anyway without his skill, it has to be some, they will take some agency from that player and figure out how to use that and be the information
is there, he's going to find it. You still get him to make a library use roll, but it's how quickly he finds it. And if he finds it really quickly, that means that there is an opportunity to prevent the terrible thing from happening. They might get there before the murder takes place because they found this critical piece of information. Yeah. Whereas if he gets a regular success, he finds it, but it might be that they turn up right as the fight's happening, so they have to get involved in a combat.
Yep.
Or if he fails, they find the information, they go to the place, but it's too late. The person they need to talk to is dead.
So you have to.
So library use is still important. Yes. It's still there, but it's affecting the plot in a different way.
Sure.
It's not an and or situation. Yeah. It's a yes but situation. Yes, you've got that information, but it's got an effect on where the plot goes next.
But you have, as a DM, you have to have a big overview of the plot's parameters and make sure that there are some consequences if they are not have a library use nerd with them, or and have a it's like like have a timer on them, or have some capacity to make sure the players are not fooling around in the library for 3 hours. They are.
Well, if they are fooling around in the library for 3 hours, the person they need to talk to dies. You know, again, you've got ways.
Yeah, and that's then. So you have to. Yeah, so you have to have a great overview and a great perspective as a GM. So, and some of the improv parts of a player agency wriggle room might dissipate in that. Big overview of a campaign, so it's a fine balance. It's using skills versus player agency versus the plot's parameters and so on.
It is, but I would also say that if your players just wander into a room and get given everything, it's not really very interesting. They're not doing anything for it. Everything's being handed to them on a plate. Even from what I remember of Trail of Cthulhu, they still have to say that they're doing things. Their characters still have to put an effort in. It's not, you know, they're still having to apply that skill, even if they're not necessarily rolling for it. Yes, you do. I mean, the whole thing is that all GMing involves improvisation. It involves reacting to what your players are doing. And I know people find that really daunting, but it is something that comes with practice. Don't be afraid of it. And again, as what we said earlier, if the players do something unexpected, don't be afraid to say, oh, can I just have a couple of minutes to think about that, please?
Yeah, for sure.
Rather than go, no, that's not what's happening, and trying to force them to do something, which is guaranteed to upset your players and remove player agency.
Yes, we want a player agency.
It is this backwards and forwards between players and the GM. It's not the GM controlling the story. It's not the players controlling the story. It's not the players getting everything their own way. It's not the GM getting everything their own way. There is that middle ground that creates that story. And success all the time is not interesting. It doesn't make interesting stories. Those failures or being too late getting the information, needing to go convince somebody else to help you, they're what creates the drama. They're what creates the tension And that's what's important in horror, is that drama and tension. The leaning over the table, holding your breath, rolling the dice to see whether you're going to make it. You know, that's all part of it too.
I love the part that you want to have the role to be important for the players as well, that I hear from you. And when you... But when I'm looking at the game, I'm pretty big fan of the Call of Divinity Lost, as you heard in my talk with Robin, because there's a built-in fail-forward system. I can always give my players the agency in the dice roll and give them the info and make it a interesting dice roll in the same term. In a stop-and-go system like Call of Cthulhu or like Dungeons & Dragons or like GURPS, and there's a lot of the pretty, especially older systems, have this flaw that we have to improvise from the dice roll because it's not built into the dice mechanics. Because in the hardcore rules, 80, I have 80 in library rules, 81 I fail. That's the rules. But if you read down the rules and have experience with the rules and can fail forward through the dice roll, you can, of course, mitigate this. As you said, you can make the bad guy win a yard in the plot's parameters or something like that.
But again, this comes back to what I'm saying. It doesn't say that in the rules. It certainly doesn't say that in the 7th edition rules.
No, it's the 7th edition rules. I haven't, but in 4th and in 5th and so on, it's...
But, you know, 5th is what? 20-odd years ago? I know some groups are playing that now, but this is one of the things that does upset me, is that we've got something that was possibly true 30 years ago, and people are still claiming that that's the case today, and it's not.
Yeah. It's just for me to figure out how to use the system, and that's very helpful for me to hear your take on it, for sure. And I might pick it up again and to make you happy.
It would make me very happy indeed. Yeah. But like you say, if you are going to pick it up again, start with the starter set.
Yeah.
You know, don't go wading straight into the Keeper's Guide. Go for the starter set, which is this beautiful... Mike did a lovely job of stripping it down to its essentials to make it as accessible as possible to people.
Yeah, for sure. I'm a big fan of the Freeligus games, which also has a built-in fail-forward in the dice system, in that system. And when I'm using... I'm playing 1920s, I'm using that system. I could try this in my next story. I have a scenario or plots lined up for after the offense of Sumé in the First World War, where the players are pinned down by German forces in the end of that offense. And that's the plot begins from there. So I could use the 100 instead, maybe. So I will try to figure that out then, for sure.
Or, you know, just break them in gently with a couple of one-offs. The way I played Call of Cthulhu when I first started, it's there as a palate cleanser. Something you do that's a little bit different to your normal game.
Yeah, when I'm playing horror games, I'm playing... It's always like a series of one-shots that links into each other. Mm-hmm. Might the character survive, or a NPC they met the next time, a character or a child of one of the characters. So they are linked together, all the small stories, but I'm not afraid to kill off my characters when I'm DMing, because it's make great stories. But I've of course tried to figure out to do it in a cool way, or in the end of the plot, or make sure I have backup characters for the characters, because some horror games are much more fun when there is a mortality involved in the game, so the players are afraid to lose their character in scenes. So so that's my takeaway for horror gaming.
They're not invincible. There should always be that risk of death. But as a keeper, you should not be going out to deliberately kill the investigators. No. And you often read in articles, they go out to kill their players. Dear heavens, please do not do that. It's, you know, GM should not be setting out to kill their investigators.
Oh, that's pretty easy. That's pretty easy.
But, you know, again, for one shot, you can get away with it. But, you know, yeah, it's this thing again that it's not PvP. You're not doing player versus player. It's not GM versus players.
No. And then that's some of the, maybe us, especially old school and especially RuneQuest, of course, but the dice rolls are so swingy in the D100 system, so mortality are very real, and sometimes the GM cannot control the dice because they are so swingy, and have, and in my experience for D100 systems, especially RuneQuest, for sure. That's just wild.
Oh, I honestly, I couldn't honestly comment on RuneQuest now, because it's 30 years since I played it. But but I mean, you talk about swingy, though.
Focused, for sure.
But let's face it, you know, like D100, you've got way less swing than you do with a D20, certainly with a D6 system, if you're depending on how many D6 you're using. I mean, I wrote a steampunk game called Cogs, Cakes and Sword Sticks, and you literally use one D6, and that is massively swingy. But again, it leans into the drama of the stories, because it's a pulp story. And it's this whole thing, which we're not going to go into here, I don't think, is that it's making sure that the system that you're using allows you to tell the sorts of stories that you want to tell. And I love the D100 system, because it's one I can remember. My brain isn't great with rule systems and remembering them, but the D100 system makes sense to my brain, and so I remember it, and I find it easy to figure out and know where I am with it.
Yeah, man, just the dice, the damage essentials in Call of Cthulhu are pretty steep, and hit by a pistol or a shotgun, you are killing off your characters pretty fast, and that was not the meaning of it, so you have to be aware of that for sure.
That's because it's based in the real world. Unfortunately, we are all too aware of what happens when people get hold of powerful guns and start shooting people with them. You're going to get very, very badly hurt. But again, this plays into, if you're playing classic Call of Cthulhu, this plays into the original stories, because they're not all guns blazing. They are investigative stories. They are sneaking around old creaky houses. If you want to do the shooty bang bang stuff, you play pulp, where you are tougher. You've got more of a chance of surviving. And I think that's sometimes the thing that people who have come from more fantasy-based games, where you're tough and you can heal and, you know, you're going to stand up to this kind of damage, is that culture shock of, it's not realistic, but it's more realistic, and guns are going to hurt you.
Pushed the D100 system at the front of me a lot of times, and just picked up, I've played Call of Cthulhu-ish games, just picked up a, like in Free Ligas games or in some Power by the Apocalypse versions of the game instead. I might jump into I haven't tried 7th edition yet, so I could try that for size, for sure.
If I've managed to convince you, then my work here is pretty much done.
Yeah, I will try. I will try that with my group next time. I have a dedicated horror group I'm playing with a few times a month. Playing a lot of different games. So author and a designer, it's a well-known and well-defined setting for sure. So how did you jump into this? And because I have taught you a lot of other game designers in this podcast, Martin Eriksson, that jumped into the Vampire 5th edition well of cesspool his partner Fire was blown away to see how a community and a bunch of nerds can rage so much on a well-defined setting as Vampire. how did you manage this when you tried to get a hold of this setting and try to formulate and create stuff for this setting?
Well, the joyous thing about Call of Cthulhu really is the fact that the original writers built in so much ambiguity, because nothing is ever really described properly. Things are never given the same name twice, or if they are given the same name, they're not necessarily described the same way. So you can get away with a lot. You know, you can twist things, you can create new creatures, you can make it do what you need it to do. So yes, there is a lot of lore there, but you don't have to use it like that. What's to say that what's been written before is the actual version? That's just somebody's interpretation of it, somebody's experience of it. Doesn't mean it's the real one. You know, so you do have that wonderful, like you said, ambiguity that allows you to really do some interesting stuff, because the whole, you know, if you go back and look at the original stories, there is this sort of nothing is certain, nothing is clearly defined. You can play with things. Just what one person sees doesn't mean it's what somebody else sees.
No. And when it's so well defined, there's a lot of lore, as you said, but you can bring that lore into a new structure, yeah, or a new version of it, but still holding on to the essentials, yeah, because there's a lot of essentials and there's a lot of rules in this well-defined setting, as you said. And how are the community toiling this? Is there have been any reach out for the community, or have the community said, cool, more stuff, let's go?
Oh, the community are insatiable, bless their hearts, otherwise I wouldn't have a full-time job. I mean, they've kept us really busy over the pandemic and lockdown. You know, they really have wanted more and more stuff. And of course, we have the Miskatonic repository on DriveThruRPG, where people can, you know, write their things and publish them. And that's huge. We do have a really vibrant community out there who write their own material, engage with our material, show up to support us at conventions, run games for us at conventions, spread the word, if you like. So we are very lucky in the fact that it is a really active, vibrant, creative community,
and there's a lot of there's a huge fan base of course, and the ability to let all players and all GMs create stuff with you is, that's a pretty unique take for this, because it's, as you said, as we said, the community have a agency and can make some great stuff with you. That's pretty cool, and it's
a wonderful thing, and it's a wonderful community. And it's really nice because it allows younger players to become invested in the community, to find their place in the community, because, you know, we're all getting older. Mm-hmm. We need fresh blood to sort of like keep the entire role playing community going, bring in fresh ideas, bring in new ideas, help the games, all of them, evolve into bigger and better and brighter things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's Miskatonic repository is fantastic because it's allowing new writers to learn their craft and hone their skills, and, you know, so we can keep an eye on that and pick out the ones that are, you know, exciting and interesting and who we want to work with in the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, bring on the next generation of creators.
Yeah, because we have to evolve our hobby and not stall in the 1920s.
Exactly. So. Well, more the 1980s yeah. than 1990s, yeah. to be fair, yeah. but, you know, yeah.
So that's pretty cool. What's next for you, Lynn? What are you working on in this moment?
Ooh. Right. Well, at the moment, we're putting the finishing touches on the Rivers of London role-playing game,
yep.
and also Regency Cthulhu.
Yeah. What is?
And then there's another project which I am about. Well, I've been sorting out the art direction for, but which I'm not actually allowed to mention because it's not been announced yet.
And looking at the Rivers of London, is that a source book for Call of Cthulhu, or how is it?
No, it's a standalone
yeah.
game. It's based on Call of Cthulhu 7th
yeah.
edition, and Ben Aronovich's Rivers of London
yeah.
urban fantasy
okay.
stories. Ben has actually described it as Call of Cthulhu, but with added hope. So, you know, it's because Ben's a gamer. Ben's a huge Call of Cthulhu fan. And it was a perfect match, to be fair. So it has elements, but obviously it's a different tone. You know, it's not that downward spiral that you get in Call of Cthulhu. There's horrific elements to it. Because, you know, it is an urban fantasy crime series. There are gory, gruesome deaths and weird goings on, but it's got a different outlook.
Yeah, that's pretty good, pretty cool. Lynn, I don't have any more for you tonight. It was so fantastic to talk to you and get a lesson in D100 systems and Call of Cthulhu. I have a lot of insights in the D100 system, but yeah, it's great to be debunked and all the myths of the evil and this conspiracy days we are living in. So it's great to have a real life debunker of D100 system badness in the talk with us. So. So it was pretty cool, Ellen. So thanks for doing this. And if you don't have anything else to reach out, I have a lot. The last thing, do you follow any Kickstarters or anything in that sort?
Oh yes, I do. What have I got?
Can you recommend a Kickstarter for us?
I don't know if it's. I think it's all the ones I've been looking at. Like all the ones I've backed lately, have all finished now. Actually. I'm just waiting for them to turn up so I can have my pretty shiny things.
What have you backed then?
Age of Cthulhu out of curiosity, plus the fact I have worked for Green Ronin, so you know I do like to support them. Over Isles, which I'm really excited about seeing, which is a lovely game. It's a follow-on to Inspire Isles, which is a game for younger role players that uses sign language. So, you know, very much about expanding accessibility and inclusiveness in gaming, and has some really lovely ideas in it. So I'm very excited to see Over Isles. Into the Motherlands, which is sort of science fiction, but through an African-American lens, Afrofuturist, that was the word I was looking for. So yes, lots of different interesting things. Because although my main focus is obviously horror and historical stuff, it's always good to have a look at what other people are doing so that you can improve your own practice and writing.
Yeah, so you have some great ideas. So we have some great ideas again. Yeah, cool. But again, I don't have a lot more for you tonight, so it was great to talk to you, Lynn.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a very pleasant chat.
That's a very big pleasure for my sake, for sure. Thank you to Lynn to talk to us about this classic game of Call of Cthulhu. Next time, already at Friday, we continue our topic on Lovecraftian games, and this time it's the Trail of Cthulhu.
Follow us on Facebook, GM Workshop, the podcast. If you want to interact with us and talk to us, give us a message